This is the Dunning-Kruger administration because the effect permeates the administration from the top down. Because the dumbest one of all is the one is the guy with the orange face who has no freaking idea. Plus, he's crazy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway to explain the legal news to me. Hey, George.
Illegal news, not legal news. Illegal news. I mean, the strategy is to be illegal and pretend to be legal. That is the strategy of the new Dunning-Kruger administration.
How can you explain to me?
Yes.
Can you explain to me why, what is happening right now?
You mean this is basically the WTF question.
Yeah, but yeah. I guess, so obviously there's so many fronts, but I'll start with the what do you know about these, the OPM and OMB, and they're just like offering people, not buyouts. Buyouts is a misnomer. They're basically just like, you know, we're going to pay.
They're kind of, it's a combination of Project 2025 and shit coming out of Elon Musk's ass. Just forgive my language. I mean, they're just making it up as they go along. And OPM, I mean, they just, you know, they're the buyouts don't really work if you talk to any federal employer lawyer. They're not really buyouts. They're basically saying, hey, if you tell us you resign, you know, effective this fall, you cannot come to work and hang out and maybe you can do stuff for us, and then you get your 7 months, so you don't have to do very much. And so that's, you know, that's supposed to be severance that they pay, but they can't really authorize severance, which is why they're doing it that way. On the other hand, it's not targeted. The thing is, it's not targeted at any particular element of the federal workforce. They send it out to basically everybody. So you have no idea if people are going to take it. If they trust the government enough to take it, you know, you may get basically the entire, let's just pick an example of a profession, air traffic controllers to quit, which would might not be good.
I would like air traffic controllers to not quit.
Yeah, no, I you know, I'd like Doge to quit. No, but it's totally. I mean, if you know, there are, I'm sure there are many places where government spends money wastefully. But the question is which ones and deciding which ones. And, you know, they're just being very, very nihilistic about it, in part because there are a lot of people on the right who have basically talked themselves over the decades that since they came so frustrated. This is my theory, and it'll be interesting to see whether you have the same theory. Cutting government is hard because the reason why all these programs are in place is that some people like them. And the fact of the matter is there's very little actual discretionary spending, non-defense discretionary spending to cut. Most of the budget, the federal budget, is defense, which, you know, is kind of important, although maybe not anymore since we are, well, actually it's more important for now that we're going to seek to invade all foreign countries and take their land away from them, I guess. And then there is the, there's Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, you know, the entitlement spending, which, that's the third rail of American politics. And the Democrats have demagogued that, and the Republicans pretend it doesn't exist. And they demagogue, so they pretend that there's a lot of things that they can cut in the government, which there really isn't all that much. But there's some, but it's not enough to make a big difference in the percent of your tax dollars and the national debt, you know, that go, it's not going to make a huge dent. So they're just doing this. So what the Republicans became then the right became very, very frustrated over decades of not really making that much of a dent in the federal budget and the size and scope of the federal government because people actually want it. And when Republican administrations, including the first Trump administration, came into power, they didn't actually do that much because, for that very reason. Now they just basically want to blow everything up nihilistically and just basically make the government not work. And then from Trump's standpoint, Trump doesn't give a shit about policy. All he cares about is making people suffer who he thinks don't like him. The problem is, of course, that a lot of the people who depend on these transfer payments that would be cut, or, you know, if they actually went to entitlements and other, you know, I mean, there's farm subsidies and whatnot, are actually poor people in red states who voted for Donald Trump. So, you know, it's just a giant mess, and they're overreaching and they're doing it unlawfully. I mean, this whole concept of impoundment, this is the other thing you were talking about, impoundment, you know, it's not, they don't have a legal basis to do it. And yet they're basically, you know, they're basically threatening to cut anything they want without congressional authorization. In other words, things that have been already authorized by Congress, they're saying, well, we're not going to spend money on that, but that's not actually lawful. President Nixon tried to do that in the early 70s, and Congress responded with the Impoundment Control Act of 1972. This is no, no, no. If we say you have to spend money, executive branch, you have to spend it. Unless
it says that in the Constitution.
It says it in the law, and the Constitution says that, you know, laws are laws and that Congress has the power of spending. So if the law says the power of the purse, if the law says the executive branch shall spend X, then the president, who actually takes an oath to enforce and follow the laws of the United States, has to obey that. So if you have to spend the money, if it says you spend the money, you spend the money. Now, the Impoundment Control Act said there would be created circumstances where the president could impound money or rescind spending or delay spending. But it created very specific circumstances where the president could do that and very specific methods by which the president would have to justify it, none of which this administration seems willing to comply with. So, even before the Impoundment Control Act, took effect, or it wasn't really involved in this case, there was a case in 1974 in the Supreme Court called Train versus, I think, City of New York, or Train versus the United States, where an attempt by the Nixon administration to rescind spending or to stop spending went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, 9-0, in an opinion written by Justice White, who was relatively conservative, and joined by Chief Justice Berger, who was was pretty conservative for his time, and Justice Rehnquist, who was way, way ahead of his time, they read the statute and they unanimously said, look, if the statute says you have to spend the money, you have to spend the money. And, you know, we looking at this statute, and Nixon administration had no power to withhold this. And so basically that's the law even without Congress's specific guidance or, you know, mandatory guidance in the Impoundment Control Act. So there's basically not a leg for them to stand on. So then what happens this week, as I understand it, is that some yo-yo lawyer, actually he's very prominent in conservative and FedSoc circles, a guy named Mark Pelletta, who's basically the general counsel in, I guess, OMB or something like that, writes some frickin' memo that basically says that, you know, blunderbuss says that, you know, all grant money or all spend, you know, that basically is frozen until we can figure out what we really want to cut or something like that. I don't know the precise language. And basically trillions of dollars in spending, including to Medicare, you know, was frozen. And people freaked out, and people called their elected representatives, and then the White House basically then had the OMB issue a memo rescinding the earlier memo without explanation, and then they had the, you know, Carolyn Leavitt dingbat they have doing press for them basically said, well, we said something like, we don't really mean that, we are still going to, you know, stop all the spending, and nobody knows what they're doing. And basically what happened was the right hand didn't know what the other right hand was doing. Mm-hmm. Nobody, the people in the White House said, well, we didn't know they were going to do this memo, even though, right, you know, you can go, the OMB, as I understand it, you have to go under, you can go down the tunnel by the bowling alley, and you can go from the West Wing there in 5 minutes. They didn't know what they were doing. And they didn't tell anybody in Congress. And, you know, this is the, you know, so what we have here is what I call the Dunning-Kruger administration.
Mm.
Yeah. You know who Dunning and Kruger are? I'm sure some of our readers do. Dunning and Kruger were these psychologists who basically said that really dumb people have no idea how stupid they are. and they think they're smart. And when they do stuff, they get into trouble because they're dumb and they don't know what they're doing. And that's what, you know, and that's what we're seeing with this administration.
There's a Dunning-Kruger effect.
There's a Dunning-Kruger effect, right. And this is the Dunning-Kruger administration because the effect permeates the administration from the top down.
Sure.
Because the dumbest one of all is the one, is the guy with the orange face who has no freaking idea. Plus, he's crazy, but that's, you know, we've been through that. He has no idea what's going on. Elon thinks, you know, Elon thinks he's way smarter than he actually is. Maybe some kind of genius.
So don't you think this is Elon? I mean, this to me, this OMB's right. Not only did he like copy and paste the memo he used at Twitter.
Twitter,
yes. He seems to think that the federal government is like Twitter, right? Because he had the experience of coming in at Twitter and being like, I'm going to fire all of you, basically.
Yeah, and he thinks he knows how everything works.
Yeah.
And Twitter was much more simple than the federal government.
Of course it is. Like, these are not analogous things. But the experience that he had was basically like, all right, I fired all these people, and then I figured out, like, okay, well, what really needs tending to?
Right.
And then I bring those people back. And it seems like that's what they think they're going to do with the federal government. Let's see what we really need. But that's not how this is going to work.
No, that's not going to how this works. And it didn't even work at Twitter. I mean, they don't make money at Twitter. I mean, he cut costs and he bought himself tons of lawsuits by people who basically had contracts and he broke them. And Twitter is just a giant unprofitable mess. And it's a shitty product now.
It is just a bad product.
And it makes zero money.
From two Twitter addicts,
it's literally just unbearable now. And I can take criticism. Okay, you know, I put stuff on Blue Sky and I get attacked for it all the time. I don't mind people attacking me. Okay, I just don't want to sway through just stuff of anonymous bots saying you're fat. And it's like, okay, I know I'm fat. It's not a big deal. I don't care. Okay, but it's also not pertinent.
I got to tell you, you look great. And
okay. I've been trying to eat more or more of the meals
the
we
factor,
advertise.
The factor, yeah. The factor,
right. You know, I mean, let's leave aside that the people who, you know, to the extent they're not bots, the people who say I'm fat are worshiping an orange blob. But let's set that aside. I don't want to fat shame anybody, including the president of the United States, who should be shamed for many other purposes.
Okay.
Yes.
But this idea.
I'm spun up today.
No, it's good.
Did you know that how many words that Trump uttered in the last 7 days? Did you see that figure?
No, how many?
Yeah, like 81 or 82,000 words he uttered on the public record. And none of them made sense. And basically, starting with after I, Donald J. Trump, they were mostly lies.
I don't want to let go of the, because we can talk about Trump and some of the things that he said and the DEI, you know, whatever. But I don't want to let go of the freeze just yet, because I do think you talked earlier about whether or not like you trust the government to give you what they say they're going to give you. It's not even about trusting the government. It's like, do you trust Elon? Because I'm pretty sure that most of the people at Twitter that he fired and did and all the vendors, like they're not getting paid.
Right. No.
So do you trust Elon? And I want to say this clearly to these workers in the federal government.
Do not quit.
Do not take this ridiculous deal.
No, and I think that message has gotten out. I mean, there's this great memo written by a federal employment law expert on just security. I think it's made the big rounds.
Yeah.
And I also think that what they are doing, I mean, it hasn't created a public backlash yet. We need, you know, and at the end of the day, we do need more public involvement. But I do think in a way, just from little tidbits that I'm hearing, that it's galvanizing the federal workforce in ways that we may not fully yet understand. Obviously, that, you know, if they're firing the heads of departments at the FBI and moving people around and sending them to the mailroom, there's a limit to what anybody can do about that. But the rank and file federal workers are pissed. Okay. And the truth of the matter is, there's a lot that they can do to make life difficult for this administration, even if they're not out there waving a flag and doing, you know, and going out there and making themselves known. And there was this old booklet from the OSS in World War II, which is the predecessor of the CIA, about sabotage. And they say, you don't have to blow shit up to sabotage things, you can just return phone calls slowly. Okay, it reminds me of that scene in Patton. I'm free associating here, but you know, this is part of the fun we have here. That Patton where Patton decides that he's going to go off and take Palermo on Sicily, way down the other end of the island, because basically he hasn't gotten enough glory. He's not getting the plum assignment, so he basically decides to go, you know, go run around the right the end of the island and make headlines. And he gets a telegram from his superiors, General Montgomery or whoever is running the overall operation on Sicily, says, do not go any farther than Agrigento or whatever the name of the town is in southern Sicily. And they hand it to him, an aide hands it to him and reads it to him and Patton says, that's what you think it says. This is George Scott. I can't do the voice. Patton actually had a very squeaky voice. That's what you think it says. I think it was garbled in transmission. Have them resend it and take your time about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they think that they can do all these things with the federal government. And, you know, the federal government is like a big aircraft carrier. It's basically, it's hard to turn. It's slow to move. And they have no, I mean, it's gargantuan, and that's part of the problem.
It's part of the problem. Hey, George, because we should say, you and I are both more limited government conservatives.
Right.
We are. So right. I'm generally favorable
right.
to bringing skepticism to the Correct. Size of the federal government.
Absolutely.
And so, actually, when we talk about this, it is with a sense of, okay, yeah, I think it is. It's bloated. It's inefficient, right. and it. God, does it need to be modernized? There's still
it's like computers. You know, it's like living in an old building.
Yeah,
it's living in an old building that you need to renovate. And just applying dynamite to it randomly, and that's going to cost you more in the long run.
It's like blowing it up while people are still living there.
Like people are still living there. Yes. I am. There's a lot of things, sentiments that I agree with that are expressed on Fox News or by lunatics. Okay? DEI, for example. All right. Yep. I don't like reverse racial discrimination, whether it is in express quotas or when things are done that are tantamount to and amount effectively to express quotas. Okay? I'm against that because I think it's divisive. It continues the identity politics now that the right has, you know, the right has taken over identity. The right have become the queen and kings and queens of identity politics for white America. I think it's poisonous. And I think it's part of the reason why we got where we are today is some of that was overdone. But I absolutely don't question the need for anti-discrimination laws. And I don't question the need for employers, including government employers, to basically try to reach out to make a workforce that's more diverse and inclusive, because you need all the talent you can get, and you need to do that. So, you know, I mean, it's not figuring out what's good and what's bad is hard to do, but to suggest, you know, on the basis of no evidence that a plane crash that happened a few hours before was because of DEI and just make that shit up, you know, to blame racial minorities and women for something that probably didn't involve any racial minorities or women is just obscene. It's just an attempt to inflame racial hatred and misogyny for political ends, to divert attention from, you know, their own failings. And, you know, and I know we talk about merit when we, how do we talk about merit when we have a drunk at the DOD? I'm not going to start with it.
No. This is right. I'm going to go, because I tweeted this earlier. I believe in merit-based hiring. Mm-hmm. And I believe in very high standards in jobs where there are life and death implications of those jobs. And it is for that reason that I oppose the nominations of Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard and Bobby Kennedy Jr. And who's the and
Dyson Bobby Tulsi Kennedy Gabbard? Doesn't even know. I mean, you know, it's okay for me not to know the difference between Medicaid Part A and Part B or whatever or not whatever.
I'm not the guy running HHS.
Okay, buddy. All right, I'm not running HHS. And if I were somehow randomly nominated for HHS, I would have someone prepare a cheat sheet, which would have that on there, so I wouldn't. Up. This isn't, you know, and I could at least wing my way through a congressional hearing, because it's not that hard to bullshit your way through a congressional hearing, truth be told.
As Kash Patel is showing us.
Right. Right now. No. And you know, but
these QAnon, these people, who's heard of QAnon?
Well, that's not bullshitting. That's just lying. Okay.
Yes, they're lying.
You know, you can just keep talking. Word salads are not necessarily lying. And you have Hegseth, who didn't know, he couldn't name, I think when Senator Tammy Duckworth asked him, couldn't name any of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, you know, a key block of nations that we have an interest in protecting from expansionist China, right? Because they're trying to take over the South China Sea. They're building islands in the South China Sea, Chinese China Sea, and taking over Philippine little lands. It's like, he couldn't name a single country there, okay? I have never memorized it. I don't study this stuff. But I could tell you, just basically because I could read a f-ing map, that the Philippines was there in that organization. I didn't know that Vietnam was there, but it is. And, you know, and Malaysia and all the countries you would suspect that are in Southeast Asia that aren't China, most of them are in there. And all you have to do, he couldn't name one.
And here's the thing about merit, right? So part of
the only thing he
works,
cares about from Asia is like sake, probably.
Yeah, but the way that it works, right, is you work your way up through a series of things that give you the building blocks of information that allow
Correct.
You to be have deep expertise in.
Or if you could be an ambassador, and you could just basically you put me in a room to make me ambassador to Burundi. You put me in a room for 3 weeks with briefing books. And I will know more about Burundi than 98% of the members of Congress.
I don't know anything about Burundi.
What?
I don't know anything about Burundi.
I don't know anything about it, but we can all learn. But, you know, we can learn this stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, these people don't care. Okay? They don't care. I mean, Bobby Kennedy, you know, with his half brainworm-eaten brain, doesn't care. He just, you know, these people do not care. And
it was
then
a big opportunity
Kosh Patel.
For the brainworm.
Yeah, the brainworm. Yeah, brainworm is. It's not a. I don't know. The brainworm kind of is getting a bad rep.
Wait, can I? I want to make two points
yes.
here. I want
to okay.
make two
Sorry,
kind I'm of. Poli- no, it's okay. I just want to make two kind of political science-y points that I want to see what you think about them.
Okay.
And they relate to this. So one is our system of government, like the Madisonian system of government, was about ambitions counteracting ambitions,
right?
It was this idea that you have these three branches of government, and the way that you sort of offset factionalism, which the founders understood was a thing that would happen, is by giving each of these locuses of power that can play off each other. But here's what's crazy, both about the hiring freeze, the freezes, and also the these nominations that Trump is putting forward.
Right.
I am watching Republicans absolutely surrender all of their power.
Right.
Right. Whether it's the power of the purse, whether it's the power of advising consent. Like, I just saw John Cornyn saying that he is going to accept Tulsi Gabbard because Donald Trump won the election and so he gets what he wants.
Right.
That is actually not how the system of government works. No. And there's this thing in there that he says, this clause that's like, you know, only under extraordinary circumstances. And I'm like, you mean like the DNI being an active security threat, like a national security threat, would that be extraordinary circumstance? Somebody who's more sympathetic to our enemies than our allies? That to me seems extraordinary. But John
having a defense secretary who knows nothing about running
knows
the defense
nothing.
Department and is an alcoholic, or at least has been an alcoholic.
Mismanaged every organization he's been in, has been accused of sexual assault.
Name it,
What, so that to me, this idea of our system of government does collapse in the face of this mentality where Republicans say, whatever Trump says goes, I will not exercise my power.
Right.
Like, if Mike Johnson's like, well, I'm just here. I'm only here because Donald Trump put me here. So I'm not going to do anything but what Donald Trump says. And so there's no congressional pushback. That is like literally, this is where the collapse of the government comes in, is when nobody holds their power.
It's basically, they're basically surrendering the separation of powers. They're behaving anti-constitutionally because they do not, their oaths are not to Donald Trump. Everybody's oaths to the Constitution. And if you're elected to the Senate or the United States House of Representatives, you have an obligation to do what senators and House members of the House are supposed to do, which is, in the case of the Senate, advise and consent.
Right.
And to basically exercise your own judgment on behalf of the people who elected you. And, and it worked pretty well mostly for 220 odd years, because you would see Democratic presidents getting into trouble with Democratic Congresses and losing big battles, and Republican presidents losing big battles to Republican Congresses. And of course, there's the inner party strife, and then, but we're not seeing that anymore. And we're even seeing, I hate to say it, but surrender by the Democrats.
Yeah.
Because I think the Democrats have this strategy. I mean, they've just been very, there have been good moments in some of these hearings. You just get the feeling that what the Democratic strategy is to basically hang out for 2 years and wait for Trump to blow himself up on something or other, right? Which he may. I think there's a decent chance he will. And then pounce and say, see? And but in the meantime, you've got people, they're not resisting, right? They're just sort of like, they're just sort of treading water because it's unpleasant to do anything else. And, they're surrendering their power too. It just feels that way. And maybe that's unfair and I hope I'm wrong, but that's the feeling I get.
Hold on. Before I move on to my second political science point, I do want to talk about this because I think it's completely right. Now, I do have some sense of why I think the Democrats are struggling in this moment, which is that I think, I've said this on a few other podcasts, but I really think that it's true that Donald Trump won sort of the cultural fight by a much higher margin than he won the actual election.
Right.
And so I think that as Republicans go on offense against things like DEI or on immigration or on some of these first fights, there is a sense among Democrats of like, what, we don't know how to respond to this because the things that our activist base wants us to say are no longer, like, it's clear to us that they are not broadly popular.
Correct.
And we're learning that lesson, so we don't know how to do it. But here's the other, but that I think is the thing that might be paralyzing them. But you're still exactly right. Here's the thing that
I think there's another thing that's paralyzing.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing paralyzing him is that they do not know how to counter lies. They just do not know how to count. They cannot say this man is a sociopath and lying. And in the combination of them having done things the wrong way in terms of overplaying the DEI and defund the police and all the politically dumb things that allowed the right to engage in extreme distortive depictions. And this is something that's happened. I mean, it didn't happen. It wasn't a Biden administration. This has been going on for 20 years. I mean, the image that's set in people's heads about the Democratic Party being a bunch of pointy-headed wackos from liberal academia and
Berkeley,
and wanting wanting to have caravans of trans kids marching into the schools and out of the, all that stuff, which is distorted and wild in the mind eye of anybody watching Fox News, it built up over many, many years, and it's hard to sort of undo. And then what they did is, they lied. They just lied about, they lied about transgender kids, they lie about everything. And it's just gotten completely out of hand. And they have to sort of figure out, I think they need a new brand. I mean, I think they need to start over in a way, and they don't know how to do it. And what's interesting is, and Tim Miller pointed this out today in a post on X, I think, he noted that Bernie Sanders, the Sanders-aligned candidate for DNC chair, actually opposes something like having a Muslim caucus some of this, the identity politics, he's pushing back on some of the identity politics.
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating because that's part of, again, not solely, I think it's just, it's part of what the helped create the reaction, the insane reaction that we're seeing today on the right.
I think that's right. I think this is a good and important conversation, actually, because there is an element of truth to what Republicans are saying on a bunch of these things, right? Like the DEI, I think, you know, a lot of like people do encounter it in right. their real lives.
Including liberals that we know in colleges and newspapers. They say, I can't believe.
And they're over it. They're right. over it. I think that's this cultural fight around DEI is sort of, I think the left has lost it. The right has won it. However,
it's going to create another backlash.
There's always a spectrum of these things where, like, there's the they have a point, this is too much, and the, like, why are you being hateful, rotten, horrible people? Right. And so this was on display yesterday when Donald Trump held that insane press conference. And before knowing any facts about anything, gets up and says, DEI is the reason that this happened. You know, families haven't been talked to yet. People are still dealing, the country is still dealing with the fact this happened. People are still dealing, like, trying to understand because people are fearful because this doesn't happen. Happen. We are all in planes all the time. We are not used to them being colliding with
others. It hasn't happened in almost 20 years, notwithstanding DEI, by the way.
There's
no logic to it. It's just lies. It's just gaslighting.
That's an insane thing. And it wraps me back to my second point, which is that it is one thing to say, you know, some of the DEI stuff has gone too far. It's another thing to do what Trump is doing, which is to scapegoat minorities at every opportunity. And
it's
bigotry. If you open the authoritarian playbook, and I do sort of shy away sometimes from doing a lot of, like, Trump's an authoritarian. Now, in part because I listen to voters and I know voters don't actually know what authoritarian means.
No, they don't.
But also because it's like, it always just feels like a little too much in some way.
It's academic and it couldn't happen here, but it's like literally, and it's over, like, it's almost like you're over intellectualizing Donald Trump to give him credit for following a playbook that has been done before because he doesn't know any of his history.
But some people around him do. And I'll tell you, there's a reason that scapegoating minorities is chapter one of the authoritarian playbook.
Correct.
It is what people do in order to both elide their responsibility for things. Like the way a normal president, just like, what do we want in our president? A lot of times halfway, we just want somebody to be a decent person and to reflect decency at tough moments.
That used to be the way we wanted to be.
So instead of getting up and saying, like, this is a tragedy, and I'm going to be talking to the families, and my heart goes out to them, and we as a country, when we're going to get to the bottom of why this happened so it doesn't happen again, you can have confidence in our aviation. Right. No. Now he has to scapegoat minorities. And not only that, do it zero. It's not even like anybody's like, I don't know, were the women? Because this is what Charlie Kirk did about the fires.
Remember, it turned out to be the pilot. The pilot of the CRJ was a white male, and then the pilot of the helicopter was a white male. I mean, not that it makes any difference.
Of course, it doesn't make any difference. That's the thing. Other than,
but it's just, but it just shows, like, he doesn't care. They do. Wait, they're just scapegoating people, and they do not care if there's any truth to it.
Any truth to it?
They're just rampant liars. They're pathological liars. And what's funny about it is not funny. What's another unusual aspect about it is, and I didn't watch the whole thing. I want to sit down at some point, you know, on an empty stomach and watch the whole presser. And he started out reading, as I've read this, I didn't actually watch it. And he read something that was like, oh, we are all Americans and things that unite us are, you know, it was like some good, like, language that you or I would have written if we were a speechwriter for a president in precisely the circumstances.
Yeah.
You know? And he read that, presumably in the monotone way that he reads this stuff that he has absolutely no moral comprehension of, no empathetic note in his mind. It means that they're just words to him that he can barely read since he's half literate. And then he goes off and says what's on his mind, which is, you know, this absolutely psychotic and pathological lying attack and mendacious and sociopathic attack on minorities and women. And, you know, with him, it's sort of to go back to the point about, you know, I don't want to give him too much credit for following a playbook. This is just ingrained in his personality.
That's right.
It is ingrained in his personality. And it is the reason why we have, you know, we have history is full of narcissistic sociopaths who attain some degree of power. And it is ingrained in the personalities of human beings, unfortunately. I mean, there are cooperative instincts in human beings, but there are also tribal instincts in human beings. And the narcissistic sociopath, a leader who has his way and has the pulpit, the bully pulpit that a president of the United States has, along not to mention Fox News and whatnot, you know, this strikes a chord in the bad parts of the souls of people.
Yeah.
And that's what we have in America today. And it's very, very dangerous. I mean, this is how we ended up with the Holocaust. This is how major war started. And this guy wants to start. He basically does want to start a war with Denmark. OK, did you see Marco Rubio had to say, said yesterday, we're serious about Greenland. OK, they're nuts. These people are nuts. And it's the same playbook because they are following what Orban did.
Yeah.
Okay. They have a bunch of people who basically went to Hungary and learned what they did over there. But the fundamental instincts driving these people, the nihilistic, narcissistic, destructive instincts of a Donald Trump, a J.D. Vance, a Bobby Lindell Kennedy, Stephen Miller. Okay, because all of these people have, you know, there are psychological issues going on there.
Sure.
And all of those people are, and then you have all the people who eat this up because deep down they want somebody to hate. And instead of like, you know, hating the Kansas City Chiefs or something, they decide to hate their fellow human being.
I too hate the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yeah, you know, but I like Taylor, you know.
Sure. She doesn't play football, does she?
No, she goes out with the tight end.
Okay.
Yeah, she's gonna. I think they're a nice couple. I like his brother who played for the Eagles.
Sure. Yes. Okay. We're gonna switch gears really quickly because
we switch gears all the time, you know.
I know. Well, this is. We're only gonna do like one gear switch this whole show because I basically had two things I wanted to talk to you about. One was we've covered it pretty thoroughly, but the other one is one where I have much stronger feelings about all the things we just discussed than I do in terms of understanding the special counsel prosecutors who have all been fired.
Yeah.
So more than a dozen federal prosecutors involved in the two criminal prosecutions against Trump, they were fired on Monday. The acting AG said they could not be trusted to faithfully implement the president's agenda because of their significant role in prosecuting the president.
And when the president's agenda is crime, I guess.
Yeah, and when the press secretary was asked whether Trump had authorized the firing, she said this was a memo that went out by presidential personnel office, out by the presidential personnel office, and the president is the leader of the White House, so yes. So, like, I guess my question is that normal? Like, would that happen in other administrations?
No. I mean, because we've never had a convicted felon who was under two separate federal indictments, become president. No, I mean, there have been there have been mass firings, for example, of U.S. attorneys,
mm-hmm.
right? Because and the president is entitled to do that, entitled to put his own people in place. But to go into the bureaucracy and fire line prosecutors is just something that's just unheard of and the reason why they're doing it is because those people prosecuted Donald Trump for crimes he actually did commit. So, yeah, it's insanely unusual and is what happens when you put a felon in the White House. And that's what we have. We have a criminal in the government, and the people who tried to enforce the laws against that criminal are going to pay the price because he's a narcissistic sociopath. He's proving it more and more every day. And I thought I was sort of over beating that drum last year because we tried to beat it so loudly. But it's like He's beating it for himself now. And this is what he's, you know, his, this is about the, you know, le tas c'est moi. He thinks the government belongs to him. It is for his ends, for his vengeance, for his sake. And so these people who crossed him and anybody who allies themselves, you know, the force of the government will be applied to them wherever possible. And so these people are fired.
Before I actually ask other questions about the specific firing, you just raised something that is interesting. What's happened in the last 10 days since he took office? Does it like meet your expectations?
No, look, nothing is surprising. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of stunning to see. I think the only thing that has surprised me is the incompetence. The corruption is what I expected. I expected incompetence. I expected, you know, abuse of power. I expected illegality. I expected overreaching. But they're really incompetent. The whole OMB memo thing. I mean, that was just clownish. It really was just a stunning, because this is what stuns me about this is it is so central to what they are doing that you would have thought, you know, they had all these stupid executive orders piled high right. that they'd pre-written. Some of them are actually direct translations from the Hungarian, as I understand it. So they had stuff ready to go because they wanted, you know, and every administration to some extent does this because you want to look like you're doing something at 1 o'clock on January 20th. You know, there's a bunch of things that you want to say, we're charting a new path. But this one was so fundamental. Okay. And affected so many people. The people in the White House didn't know. The people, like, basically just a five-minute walk down a hallway to talk to this, you know, they didn't know. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. And then they couldn't explain it when they're asked about it at a press conference. I mean, it's just absolute chaos. And what it shows is you have a bunch of people running around with a president who doesn't give a flying F about policy. Okay, it's all about making noise, getting attention, and satisfying his ego. You have a White House chief of staff who you haven't heard anything from, who has zero, basically virtually no federal governmental experience. She's just a political hack from Florida, a skilled political hack from Florida.
Yeah.
And you have this whack job Elon Musk, who is, you know, destroyed Twitter and decides to use the same playbook to the federal. You have a bunch of people running around doing stuff. And it's just, it's chaotic and incompetent. I mean, it's not surprising because remember how the story about how President-elect Trump chose Matt Gaetz to be his first attorney general pick?
I do.
Right? Yeah, basically they were on Air Force Trump or whatever the hell they call that plane. And who's the Russian guy? Boris Badenov? No.
Boris Epstein.
Epstein. Yeah, I know him. I know Boris. I've had lunch with Boris. I know him from years back. Gets Trump alone in the cabinet and says, Matt Gaetz is the guy. And he does it. And Susie Wiles, the incoming chief of staff, is like two cabins down, and she has no f***ing idea that this was just done.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it is classic Trump.
Hey, did you catch Paul Rosenzweig's piece in The Atlantic? So our buddy Paul Rosenzweig had a piece, and it was really about, hey, these guys have figured this out. Like, they are competent this time, and that's really scary. And I read it, and I was like, you know, I don't think that's right. And I got to tell you, this is almost a secret. I'm not sure I feel like... I am a little glad to see how clownishly they've handled this OMB stuff, because the way that the incompetence really does shine through reminds you that these guys don't know what they're doing. Like, the worst case scenario, right, is that they come in and the velociraptors have learned to work the door handles, and suddenly they're pulling all the levers and they really know how to, like, use the loopholes in the law, you know, and like skate by on things that are almost legal or that are, you know, that are kind of opaque. No. That's not what they're doing. They're doing ham-fisted, incompetent, like smash and grab jobs, most of which won't hold up in court. Right. And they are getting sued the whole time. Right. I guess for me, there is something comforting about the fact that it's like, oh, no, because when they do this kind of overreach and they betray the fact that they have no idea how government works, it means that they will find themselves in a backlash situation eventually.
I agree with all that. Whether the backlash is going to be sufficient to save democracy and save the republic remains to be seen. But I do think they've learned some stuff.
Sure. Right?
They absolutely have learned. Trump has learned that you cannot have people in place who believe in the rule of law and who are willing to put the rule of law and follow the law above your personal whims. Okay, so he has absolutely learned that. And then the people around him have learned that as well, to the point that you're not going to get anybody of that type to work in this administration. And everyone knows that they're following what used to be called in an earlier era in another country, leaning toward the Führer, okay, where you basically do what the leader wants you to do without his telling you because you just anticipate what he wants.
Yeah, he says, like, I don't want to see so-and-so anymore. And that's all they have to say for somebody to know, right. To make the boss happy, I got to disappear so-and-so.
Disappear so-and-so, send him on the train to Poland or something or other. So, And they've learned some stuff from the Hungarians, from Orban, because they've had the right-wing coteries and think tanks in America going over and holding conferences in Budapest. So they learned a lot of the same techniques. Not all of them port over. And then you have the fact that you have chaos and disorder because none of these people are honorable people.
Right.
They are all in it for themselves. And Trump is completely, in his sociopathic way, is completely driven by the moment. He doesn't have, he has no strategy as such. He is completely impulsive. And what you have is chaos. You have a lack of, you basically have people who are in it for themselves and people who are not competent because the competent and decent people won't go in the administration. And then you have his own chaotic mind, which just goes from one thing to the next and just randomly says stuff. Like, for example, I think that whole press conference yesterday, which we were talking about, they did not intend him to go off on DEI, whoever sent him out there.
Right.
But they're also not going to stop him.
If they even sent him. Yeah. I mean, he might have just been like, I'm going out there.
Right. No. They're back to where they were in the spring of 2000, when Trump basically lost that election in 2000, not because Joe Biden was this magnificent candidate. It was because Trump would go out there and have these pressers every day during the pandemic for about a month or two. And they were ridiculous and embarrassing and absurd. And they made him look like a fool. And his poll ratings dropped. But back then there were people who could say, you've got to stop doing this. Someone I may know, maybe one of those people. And those people aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
And Susie Wiles is not going to tell him to stop. I mean, she may kind of gently, but it's like, it's not worth it to anybody to do that. And it's not, and he's much, much worse. And he's also, I mean, one reporter I was talking to, I haven't watched the video of this press conference, but he's mentally struggling much more than he ever has before.
Yeah.
Okay. He gets away with it because, unlike Biden, he's not soft-spoken. He just goes rah, rah, he's barfing words out. But it looked to one reporter who I was talking to about it that the DEI stuff just randomly came out of his brain. It just was sort of something. He was just reaching for something and he couldn't find. And it was the first thing he grabbed onto.
That's interesting. You know, you should watch the video because there's this exchange with Caitlin Collins.
Oh, I heard about that.
Where she's like, but what evidence do you have that DEI has played any role in this?
Fair question, right.
And he's like, I have common sense. And he's like, and that's a stupid question. And right. You're just like.
Perfectly good question, yeah.
It's going to be a long 4 years of this.
No, it's been. Look, I said today on Blue Sky, I said that the Caroline Kennedy's video statement, which happened like 36 hours ago, seems like 6 months ago.
We are going to age. This is going to age us all. Yeah. In some ways, time is a flat circle because we're back here again. And in other ways, it just feels like, yeah. An infinite, I don't know. Yeah.
Every day is a year. I mean, we've already blown an hour on this. It's crazy. I know.
We should wrap it.
Yeah.
All right. George Conway, as always, thank you for explaining the legal news to us.
It wasn't even that. The illegal news.
Illegal news to us. Guys, we will be back next week, and we will talk to you soon. Bye.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the emoluments to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.